Hello and welcome back to another episode of UFO Encounters Worldwide. This is your host, Jesse Peek, MUFON State Section Director for the state of Pennsylvania, City of Philadelphia. And today you're going to be hanging out with me, your host. We're going to be talking and breaking down Project Twinkle, which actually took place right after the Roswell sightings, which is really interesting. You really don't hear too much about that. It was only a year after Roswell that these sightings started to occur, and the military did a whole investigation into these sightings. So we're going to break that down. We're going to go over some of the classified documents and really just give you the all around of what went down and the results of the investigation from both sides, of witnesses and the military. We're also going to be going over a triangular UFO spotted over Ontario, Canada, witnessed by two homeowners while they were in the home. It's a really good case in this month's MUFON Journal. So we'll give you the case number. So if you have access, you can look up the videos and photos that were attached to the case. And we'll go over the details and the findings of that case as well. So we have a bunch of information for today's episode. So as we like to say, strap on them seatbelts. We're going for a ride. Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 123 of UFO Encounters Worldwide. This is your host, Jesse Peek, MUFON field investigator in the state of Pennsylvania, City of Philadelphia. And today we have no special guest. You'll be hanging out with me today. We got some really cool stuff to go over. We're going to be breaking down Project Twinkle, which is a bunch of sightings that happened actually right after Roswell. There was an investigation done by the military, which is codenamed Project Twinkle. We have some declassified documents to go over, and it goes over what they investigated, their findings. We're also going to go over what was actually reported and what the people think compared to what the military came to the conclusion of. Also, some of the people that worked on the project. We're going to go over it all. It's a really big thing that I don't think it's talked about too much, because especially, you know, we all talk about Roswell over and over and over again. But this happened only a year after Roswell, these sightings started happening. So, I mean, it could have been a continuation from that, but we really don't know. But we'll break that down today, go over that stuff. Also, there is usually we go over the top cases from the MUFON Journal. This month, there's one big case in there. So I figured we would touch on that. It's a triangle UFO spotted over Ontario, Canada. We're going to be talking about the two witnesses that were in the home at the time that actually saw this object fly silently over their home. Very big case. We're going to break down what was reported to MUFON, the investigator, and all the details with that as well. So we have a bunch of stuff to go over today. I wanted to talk a little bit about, before we dive into everything, you know, I have some reports of everything that was reported to MUFON last year, our numbers, statistics. So we'll touch on that as well. I don't know if you guys know, but I've been sponsoring for the Curiosities Festival. It's coming up in May. Really big event. It's the first time it's going to be happening. We have a great turnout already. We have over 100 vendors that are going to be there. It's $5 a person. And I mean, the event is all day long from 12 p.m. to 7 p.m. at night. And it's an all-day event. $5 a person. We're going to have speakers on the UFO phenomenon. We're going to have people talking about a whole bunch of different stuff. We're going to have live performances, curiosity performances, sword swallowers, fire spitters. I mean, really cool stuff. We just added a planetarium to the event as well. It's also done by another MUFON field investigator who is an astronomer, Dr. Nick Placco. So he'll be there with that. Doing classes all throughout the day. Seven people can fit inside this planetarium. It is absolutely amazing. I've experienced it at one of the old MUFON conferences, and I think everybody needs to experience this planetarium, because it's really cool. If you haven't been inside one, it's an experience, and I'm sure you'll love it. There's also going to be over 100 vendors, like I said. They're going to have all kinds of UFO, paranormal stuff selling. Everything is along the same lines of the Curiosity Festival. It's going to be great. There's going to be activities as well for the kids, you know, all kinds of stuff. So it's a great day. And for $5 a person, you really can't beat it. Most of the conferences today go over, 35 and up for a ticket. So $5 a person is actually going to be excellent. I'll be there as well, helping run the event. We're going to have a bunch of other MUFON people. Our UFO speaker is Robert Spearing, who is the Director of Investigations International for MUFON. Great guy. He's worked on some of the best cases that MUFON has ever come across or has been reported to MUFON. And not just here in the States. Robert deals with everything that's international. So these cases come from all over the world. He'll be talking about some of those cases and the work that he does. I've had him on the show twice already before. So a lot of you that have been listening have already, you know, listened to Robert before. Really good stuff. I mean, every time he's been on the show, he kills it, takes it away. Really good person to have there. We also have some recce people and some reader people that are going to be speaking on that as well, interacting with the audience. And then I believe we're going to have another person there talking about history of the local neighborhood and then maybe some of the hauntings and things like that. So that'll be really cool. And like I said earlier, we're going to have somebody that's, you know, curiosity performances. One of the acts that's going to be there is an actual fire spitter, person that plays with fire and does crazy stunts with it. So that's a part of it as well. We're going to have live bands playing all day long. So, I mean, live music, you can't beat that. There's going to be food, drinks, and then you can enjoy the vendors and all the activities. So, I mean, it's a great day. I think you guys should really do it. If you're interested, like I said, tickets are $5 a person. You can get all that information over at my website at ufoencountersworldwide.wordpress.com. Please check it out. It's going to be great. So I figured out we would kick off today. MUFON put out their reports from last year, 2020 UFO reports in 2023, and compared to the unknowns, to the amount of events that were reported to us, just to give you an idea of how many events happened last year in each month and how many of them were unknowns. The big statistic that's out there is usually 95 to 96% of UFO sightings that are reported can be identified as natural phenomenon or identified flying objects, you know, just misidentifications. Something I tried to, you know, it's good to get educated on this stuff, especially if you have a sighting. You know, I always say, if you see something in the sky, you know, try to do some background into it, seeing what you might have seen yourself, just to educate yourself on, you know, what it possibly could be. A lot of times people will report a sighting and because they're not educated on the subject, it winds up being a reflection most of the time or some kind of identified object that we're able to find. And a lot of times people get upset when you tell them it's a reflection. But I mean, it does happen. Some people are very thankful and they learn and we try to teach that. But these reports are all from last year, 2023, each month. MUFON gets a lot of events that occur, and these are all events that occurred for each month. It was a total of 4,423 events that occurred last year that were reported to MUFON. These are cases with, you know, video, photographs, etc. January, to kick it off last year in 2023, there was 362 events. 71 of them were reported or investigated and decided to be unknowns. Pretty good number actually for that. And that's 19.6% of the reported sightings for that month to be unknown. And I don't know if you guys are familiar with MADAR. MADAR is a system that anybody can buy in their home, any investigator or just a researcher or someone that's an enthusiast. And you can buy them, put them in your home. And what they do is they actually detect things that aren't normal things flying in our sky. So, for example, a MADAR unit's not going to pick up a airplane, helicopter, drone, anything with a normal tracker on it. It's not going to do that. It picks up things that are abnormal. So a lot of times we use these to track. That's what they're made for, to track unidentified flying objects. And you can actually go onto MADAR.com, their website, and you can actually check the MADAR data. And you can actually see where each MADAR unit is in each state, how many. And a lot of the times what a lot of people in MUFON are doing, I know here in Pennsylvania, Last time I got together with the state director and the chief investigator, we're actually setting these MADAR units up across the state of Pennsylvania. So as objects, unidentified flying objects that come across the state, we can actually track their flight going from one side of the state to the other. And if we get the same amount of hits and the levels are all correct, you know, and it doesn't come up on Flight Radar 24, which tracks normal flights, we know that we're tracking an unidentified object. And it also alerts you to let you know that these things are flying in the sky. So each unit has an alarm on it. So when it tracks something that's unidentified, the alarm will go off and you can go on your computer at home and read the data. And that data is very, very important when it comes to investigating normal UFO sightings. So for example, when I get a case, I always go and check MADAR, and I check the closest MADAR units around to see if anything was abnormal on that date at that time, just to see if anything pops up. And you can track it for as much time as it is in the area, so you know if it was that object or not. So there was actually in January two MADAR matches. So two cases were able to be matched up with MADAR in January of those 362 cases, which is pretty cool. I mean, that just gives you more evidence as to this object being an unknown object, you know, with the MADAR data. So it's pretty cool. Going on, we got February was 472 events, 89 unknowns. I mean, that's a high number, 89 unknowns. And then it goes on to 405 March and 63. The numbers kind of drop a little bit. But to give you that feel, like I said, it was 4,423 total number of events. And then, you know, your medium range is in that, you know, 15% area of those sightings. So yeah, it's basically the 95% are true identifieds, and that 5% is unknown. So just pretty cool stuff. And I thought it was pretty neat because when I read the writing that came along with the report in the journal, it stated here, and I just want to, this is exactly what it says out of the journal. It says, you know, how many, what were the numbers of ufology? How many 2023 sightings float in the MUFON? It says, quote, a person under 40 unfamiliar with the UFO phenomenon could be forgiving for thinking sightings began to be reported in quantity only early in the century, and with most emanating from members of the military, pilots, radar operators, etc. And I think that's the quote in the journal. And I think it's really interesting because I'm in the process of finishing my book now. And this is something that I bring up because ever since we started having, you know, hearings in the Capitol, we had the first hearings ever on UFOs. It was a great time for ufology. It's still a great time. There's a lot of new stuff going on. We're having more hearings, classified briefings, all kinds of stuff's going on. But if you notice that the military with these briefings, they don't go past the early 2000s. I mean, everything is from the early 2000s up to today's date. You know what I mean? Nothing really goes back before that. No data they ever come up with, nothing they talk about, nothing they show. And it kind of makes the younger generation, like this quote says, feel that this is a newer phenomenon. And this is not a new phenomenon. I mean, this is going on from biblical times, sightings of UFO and unidentified objects. So I think it's important that we make sure that this is not a new phenomenon. And this is, you know, we educate our younger generation that this has been going on long, long before we've been walking around, you know, from the 1900s. I mean, this goes on way, way before that. And, you know, I've been trying to educate people on that and try to bring it up to show people, look where the military starts talking about this stuff. None of it goes before the early 2000s. So it's really interesting that the quote was in this journal this month about that stuff. I just thought it was interesting. I'd share that with you. So I'm not the only one thinking that. And I think it's important to make sure that we keep it going so it doesn't become a new phenomenon. And we don't want that to happen because there's been too many people that, you know, I've looked up to in the field that have done hard work in this field that deserve to, you know, that all their hard work. I mean, that's a part of UFO history. And we've got to make sure that stays that way. So for the first half today, we're going to go into the triangle UFO that was spotted above a house in Ontario, Canada. And then the second half of the episode, we're going to break down Project Twinkle, which is going to be a great part of the episode. So this is in Ontario, Canada. This was seen over a home. I'm going to give you the case number. So if you have access, if you're a member or a field investigator, you can look up the case number and you can see the photos and videos that go along with this case. So I'm going to read the report to you and give you all the information about it. So two UFO witnesses in St. Pascal, Ontario, had an encounter with a triangular object on March 31st, 2021. Yes, sometimes we get cases that are new to us, but they were from a couple of years back. Sometimes we get them from 1990s, sometimes they're a couple of years. This one's only a few years old. The case number for this is 117117. Again, that case number is 117117. During the night, a camera on the witness house recorded a UFO, and about 2 minutes after, power of the camera unexpectedly went off. However, they ultimately could watch the recorded video of a large triangular-shaped object hovering over the witness's home, end quote. So we see this a lot, especially with the project I run, Project Bat Tech, of electrical phenomenon that occurs during these UFO sightings. So I find it very interesting. As soon as the object was seen on camera, the camera short-circuited and went off. We see this a lot with cell phones, vehicles, etc. I mean, we know this happens. So the witness, this is what the description of the object was from the witnesses. Quote, the spaceship was a black triangle shape with yellow and a smooth bluish light beam and reddish light on top of it. This is what the MUFON witnesses told the field investigator who interviewed them at the time. One witness was doing paperwork in his garage office when he suddenly felt an unusual vibration all over the place and went to check the house security cameras. The cameras recorded something the witness had never seen before. Shortly afterwards, they went outside and the object was just above the house. One of the witnesses described what was seen. I noticed a large triangular-shaped object with beams of light faintly visible that went from one side of the house to the other and on both sides of the object and pulsed about a few times on and off. I did not observe any sound from the object, even though it was only about 200 feet above the house and was illuminated by three lights, all symmetrical, in a reddish light. It was an uncommon thing and unreal to us. The witness tried to keep the object in view, noting that, quote, the object was hovering over my home and I also felt something scanning the place. Then when I checked the house cameras, I saw three beams of light moving around less than 200 feet from where I was doing my paperwork in the garage. I could feel the vibration on my body start shaking, and not too long after, my internet shuts off and we lost all electricity. We had the impression that the lights were following and observing us. Even though we were having weird feelings that night and facing something unknown, the sighting must have lasted about 1 minute and 40 seconds, I would have to say. It was moving, and I know it was not an airplane neither, nor a drone. I have drones myself, and I can recognize one. The thing was unpredictable, but we know what we saw, and my body was shaking from the object. My house camera recorded approximately 1 minute and 38 seconds to 2 minutes, and after that, the video shuts off. We lost internet connection and all of the electricity in the home. We had a complete power outage. End quote. So this is exactly described from the witness. And to actually see, here's the thing too. A lot of times you'll notice that everything just shuts off. So he actually seen this object on the camera. It actually got recording of the object. And then halfway through the sighting, I mean, it went out and all of the electricity went out, not just that. So this thing was able to fly only 200 feet above the home and completely cause a power outage, which is incredible. And to witness that happen is incredible as well. So here we go. So in total, this on the CMS file on this case includes photos, videos, and drawings. So if you have the case number, it's 117117. You can go on there and see the photos, videos, and the drawings that were sent in from the witnesses. Sometimes, you know, we get the video and we get the photos, but sometimes having those drawings It kind of gives us a view from how the witness viewed it instead of just the camera. A witness can feel things and see things in a different sight than what something records. And sometimes we even see that, you know, there was two witnesses in this case. But when we go to interview these witnesses, both witnesses could see something completely different. So when they draw this, we're able to see this in real person, real view. So just to give you a little history on triangular objects throughout time, they actually, Michael Stratt, the military aerospace historian with MUFON, said he's convinced that about 95% of triangles reported by eyewitnesses are in fact man-made aircraft, which makes sense. We hear a lot of rumors about the TR-3B. We've seen drawings, we've seen testing of odd aircraft. So that would make sense completely. And Michael Stratt is a historian. He really knows his stuff. Somebody that I will be trying to get on the show this year. The remaining 5% unknown, you know, so he's saying 95%, 5% unknown of these. The analysis thus falls into two camps. One says that triangles are human-made, while the other says they are not. Yet we should keep an open mind until all the evidence is available. The CMS file includes an analysis of other UFO triangle sightings, including one reported around the same time the year before this event happened. So we'll read that. That's actually pretty interesting. Yeah. And then regarding triangular shapes, the analysis states occasionally it seems that a field with as yet determined characteristics can exist between certain charged buoyant objects in loose formation, such that depending on the viewing aspect, the intervening space between the forms of area, view as shape, often triangular, from which the reflection of light does not occur. The analysis also speculates that hypothesized plasma formations through their magnetic, electric, and electric fields could have the potential to induce the observer's vivid but mainly incorrect perceptions. So I know that was a little bit much, but to break that down is what they're saying is that, you know, like I said earlier when we started the show, it's good to educate yourself on reflections, on what you could possibly be seeing, because we do a lot of the times misidentify things that we see in the sky. And that's what this is saying here. And it's very easy to get three points of light and to think something is a triangular object. So they're saying most of the time that these triangular objects can wind up being something else. And like Michael Stratt said, 95% of the time, we find that it's a man-made object or something that can be identified, and it's not a true UFO. So it's just interesting to know the facts, but there is that 5% that is true. This case that we just went over, case 117 is extremely interesting to see an object that close. That had to be something special. So again, check it out if you can. If you guys haven't become a member of MUFON yet, I mean, you can pay monthly. It's very cheap, or just become a yearly member and you get access to the CMS database. So whenever we do cases here, you can take that case number, look it up, and go check out exactly what the witness saw so you can get a better idea for yourself. So that was that case. I just thought it was interesting. I thought I would share it with you. You could probably find it. Maybe it was reported through other places as well. But if you get the MUFON Monthly Journal from being a member, that case is in that journal. So I highly recommend checking it out. So that's it for the first half of the show. We're going to go ahead and take our quick break and commercials. And when we get back, we're going to definitely do a deep breakdown of Project Twinkle, something I thought was really interesting myself, and I thought I would share with you guys today. So we'll be back right after these commercial messages. Hello, everybody. This is your host, Jesse Peek. I'm happy to announce coming up this year in 2024, on May 4th, is the Curiosities Festival, which will include speakers in the field of UFOlogy, the paranormal, and Bigfoot. We'll also be having live performances throughout the day, live bands, food, activities, and more. Tickets will only be $5 a person, and it'll be from 12 p.m. to 7 p.m. at night. Again, this is for the 2024 Curiosities Festival. You can get this information over at our website at UFOencounters.com. worldwide.wordpress.com. We look forward to seeing you there.
UFO Encounters Worldwide wants to hear from you. Have an experience or a sighting you want to share? Contact your host, Jesse Peek, at ufoencountersworldwide@gmail.com today.
This is your host, Jesse Peek. Check out our official website at ufoencountersworldwide.wordpress.com. Read up on UFO articles, including abductions, close encounters, sighting cases, megalithic structures, and more. Also, check out our new Facebook group. You'll get updates on guests every week, new events coming up, and our schedule of who we're going to have on in the future. Again, that's UFO Encounters Worldwide Facebook group and our website at ufoencountersworldwide.wordpress.com.
Have you always been curious about the unknown, the unexplainable? Do you find yourself intrigued by the mysterious and paranormal side of our world? Then Let's Find Out with co-host Diego is the podcast for you. Join in on an adventure into the world of the inexplicable and get insights from experienced researchers, investigators, and experts. Listen to mind-bending discussions and fascinating stories as Let's Find Out explores the strange, mysterious, and paranormal. Let's Find Out with co-host Diego is a unique and engaging podcast that uncovers the mysteries of the cryptic and unknown. With insightful interviews and discussions, they discover the very latest theories, discoveries, and investigations that may someday give us the final answer as to what may be behind the veil of reality. Available on Spotify, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, YouTube, iHeartRadio, Radio Public, TuneIn, and Rumble.
UFO Encounters Worldwide would like to announce our brand new home at the UNX Network. Listen to us every Saturday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time to hear UFO Encounters Worldwide podcast. That's on the UNX Network. All right, welcome back to the second half of episode 123, breaking down Project Twinkle and the triangular UFO spotted in Ontario, Canada. So for the second half today, we have a lot of information on Project Twinkle, so that's going to be the full second half of this episode today. Very, very interesting case here. Something that I don't hear get talked about too often when you talk about ufology. And I'm going to guess that there's a good amount of people out there today that's listening to the episode that really has no idea what Project Twinkle is. Now, one of the reasons that I found that this was fascinating and that I wanted to bring this up and talk about this today is because Project Twinkle, the investigation done by the military was done in the early 50s, 1951. But the sightings themselves happened in 1948 and 49. And some even happened in the 50s, early 50s, when the investigation was occurring. Now, if you're a UFO enthusiast, we all know that 1947, Roswell, 1948, we have Socorro, Mexico, all that kind of stuff in those years. But you don't ever hear about Project Twinkle and the sightings that occurred after Roswell. So that's why we're going to bring that up today, and that's why we're going to talk about it, because, you know, anybody that would look at the data and look at Roswell data and then look at Project Twinkle, common sense says, okay, are these the same objects that have been seen in continuous years with the crash of Roswell? Were these objects that people seen in Project that was investigated in Project Twinkle, were these the same objects that crashed at Roswell? I mean, there were green lights, but I mean, we don't know what color of the Roswell crashed UFO was either. So, I mean, there's the possibilities are really endless, but it's just interesting. And to not really hear about this stuff too much. So that's why I thought we would bring it up today. I'm going to give you a little quick rundown of it, and then we'll get into some details of the entire case. And then we're going to get into some of the declassified documents, because just to give you an idea of what happened during the investigation of Project Twinkle in the 50s, really cool stuff here. So I figured that's why we would go over it today. So to do the quick overview of it, to give you an idea of what we're going to be talking about, between 1949 and 1951, the U.S. Air Force ran a program that was called Project Twinkle to learn more about mysterious light phenomenon being seen by military personnel, mainly in the southwestern United States and often near or over sensitive military sites. By the way, these were not far. These were in New Mexico, these sightings. So Project Twinkle was also involved looking into reports of green fireballs being seen in the sky. Project Twinkle was actually part of another classified program called Project Grudge. Project Grudge was also a U.S. Air Force project to investigate UFOs, which we all know began in 49 to 51. Grudge came after Project Sign and a similar project program that ran from 47 to 49. So it was Projects Twinkle, Grudge, and Sign were all precursors of Project Blue Book. But we always hear about Grudge and Sign and Blue Book, but we never hear about Project Twinkle. Why is that? So in the Project Twinkle documents, light phenomenon is documented above and around military facilities, which we've heard about throughout the years many times, especially with the nuclear facility bases of phenomena shutting down nuclear weapons, all that kind of stuff. People were seeing green fireballs over New Mexico in 1948, only a year or so after Roswell. Reports came from neighboring states. The United States Air Force at first attributed the sightings to flare guns because many people had them in private hands after World War II, which is, you know, a bunch of BS. There's no way that people are shooting flare guns up, and that's what the hundreds of people are seeing, describing as these objects in the sky. So to give you, we're going to go over some of the events and how it happened, and then we'll get into the declassified documents here. So the events. At about 9:30 p.m. on the 5th of December, 1948, a bright green light flashed past the United States Air Force C-47 Dakota and another airliner over New Mexico. The crewmen on the C-47 saw the light arc toward them. Something no meteor would do or no planet would do. They agreed with the captain of the airliner to report the sighting to Kirkland Air Force Base. This was the second mysterious green light they had seen on the flight. A few minutes later, a Pioneer Airlines DC-3 Dakota radioed Kirkland with a similar report. The green light had headed straight for the plane at 9:35 p.m., forcing the pilot to take evasive action. When the plane finally landed at Albuquerque, the crew were grilled by United States Air Force intelligence officers, of course. They're going to swear in the secrecy, so they never seen nothing. And honestly, we know we're going to get into it. The Air Force obviously did an investigation and tried to say this was lights in the sky, it was natural phenomenon. Why would you send United States Air Force intelligence officers to go and talk to these individuals and grill them about it? If it was just lights in the sky and they were natural, it doesn't make sense. So the U.S. Air Force was particularly interested in the above events because these unusual UFOs had been seen skimming around New Mexico, an area of high sensitivity, because it was home to the greatest concentration of secret military installations in the continental U.S. Dr. Lincoln LaPaz, a lot of us know his name from the field of ufology, an expert in tracking meteors, was called in to head the investigation. If the fireballs were meteors, he would be able to find their points of impact and fragments. Investigation showed five green fireballs had been seen on the 5th of December. LaPaz calculated the impact zone of the largest, investigated that zone thoroughly, and found nothing. At a conference of scientists held at Los Alamos, New Mexico, in February 1949, it was concluded that fireballs were a natural phenomenon, but an unknown one. LaPaz was then put in charge of Project Twinkle to be funded by the United States Air Force to discover more. So in my opinion, we know they're not fireballs. I mean, come on, it's not what it is. And he would have found that the impact sites, if that's what they were, meteors, like I said earlier. So La Paz's plan was to set up three, let me try to get this pronunciation right, cinetheodolite stations to film and record fireballs' precise location, altitude, size, speed, and chemical structure. But only one camera was made available to them, and the investigating team always seemed to arrive at a sighting location after the local flap was already over. And the United States Air Force failed to come up with all the required funds. Although many fireballs have been seen in New Mexico, and the 165 people witnessed a giant green fireball explode silently over Arizona on the 2nd of November, 1951, none of these occurrences were ever caught on film. On the 27th of December, 1951, La Paz declared Project Twinkle a failure and closed it down. By the end of 1952, the fireballs themselves had stopped appearing and reports did stop. So a quick assessment of what the United States Air Force did, just to give you an idea. In 1952, the United States Air Force Decorate of Intelligence recommended that Project Twinkle remain classified. Now, let's stop right there. La Paz closed it down. They couldn't come to any conclusions about anything. And he said it was a failure, Project Twinkle. So if Project Twinkle was truly, honestly a failure, why would the United States Air Force continue to keep this classified? It doesn't make sense. Just like, why would you send intelligence officers to go grill pilots that seen green lights in the sky if it was nothing? If it was just natural phenomena, it doesn't make sense. So the intelligence project remained classified. No scientific explanation of the fireballs, and some reputable scientists still believed they are man-made. Of course, there was always skeptical scientists that the Air Force bought on board to tell you that it was just normal stuff. The speculation was that they were some kind of spy device too, as well. More than 40 years later, there is still no convincing answer to the riddle of green fireballs. So still to this date, there is nothing, and they finally declassified the documents. But there's still no conclusion. The Air Force never gave a final assessment of what their findings were. So to this day, it's still unknown, and it's still controversial. It's still talked about. Now, like they said, 165 people saw these objects. And you're going to tell me 165 people saw planets or meteors? I don't really think so. I just don't think that's how it would work. So let's get into the declassified documents part of this. I'm going to read you some of the declassified stuff. You can go on the blackvault.com, John Greenwald. A lot of people know him. He has the blackvault.com, a lot of declassified, pretty much the largest database on declassified documents that there are. But you could find the documents on Project Twinkle here and go through them and read them. We're going to go over like the most important parts of it. Stuff that I picked out that I think is important that you guys would be interested in. Please go and check it all out if you want more interesting stuff to see, and actually get more detail on it. But we're going to hit some of the top reports that they did in their investigation. And remember, this is from the Air Force, and La Paz. We'll get into all of it. So in view of the unprotective nature of the contract with Landair, it was decided to make further inquiry concerning recent aerial objects. So we're starting from the beginning of the investigation from the Air Force into these lights. This started on the 9th of August, 1951. The situation was discussed with Lieutenant Colonel Cox of the 17th OSI District, Kirkland Air Force Base. Until the 15th of March, 1950, the district had been diligent in forwarding copies of the reports on aerial object phenomenon. Since then, no reports had been received by Geophysics Research Division. Okay, so shortly after 51, they weren't getting any more reports. Colonel Cox advised that reports of strange aerial phenomenon were still received by the 17th OSI office at the rate of once or twice a month. So the reports were coming in only once or twice a month after 50 and 51. Not as much as when it was happening in 48, 49, and 50, and early 50. So at the rate, most of the reports originated from personnel at Los Alamos, which is pretty interesting. Now you're talking about people, scientists, that are working at this location of the military, Los Alamos, doing secret work. And they're the ones that are seeing these objects. Aren't only intelligent people supposed to be working, scientific people be working at Los Alamos? So wouldn't you think they would know what they're seeing? And don't you think they can tell a difference between a meteor or a comet? Just my opinion. So the OSI files were reviewed. A summary that was covering recent reports was attached. It was learned that representatives from the LIFE and also Agassiz were interested in publishing articles on aerial object phenomena. On the 27th of August, 1951, developments concerning aerial phenomena were discussed at Holloman Air Force Base. Lieutenant John Albert, previously associated with the project, had now been transferred from Holloman. Therefore, the project was discussed with Major Edward A. Doty, who assumed responsibility. Major Doty, who seemed thoroughly acquainted with the situation, advised that there have been very few reports. So they were trying to basically say there was nothing to the story. And like they said, there was only one or two reports at that time, so they could kind of do that and get away with it. You know, just the good old military. So let's see here. Aerial phenomenon in the vicinity of Holloman since 1950 was pretty low. The populace around Holloman Air Force Base seemed to have lost their sensitivity as observers because nothing was really being done about it, which we all know that's how it works. Even during a meteor shower of the from August 11th to the 12th of 1951, no alarming reports were received. So nobody reported when the meteor shower actually happened, which is what they were trying to say these objects were. Nobody reported a sighting during that time. Now, on the 4th of March, 1951, 9 Bell personnel reported sighting between 14 and 20 bodies, not unlike a flock of geese. On 9th of July, a red glowing ball was sighted by a sergeant stationed at Corona Experimental Radar Site at Corona, New Mexico. Corona, New Mexico. Where the other crash happened. I mean, this is the same area. It's the same area. More recently, a pilot reported some aerial objects, which after investigation were identified as planets. Come on, man. Pilots are not going to misidentify a planet. I just don't see it happening. Maybe. I mean, I don't know. I just don't get it. So let's move along a little bit more, getting a little more detail here. So many of the sightings, going further after a lot of investigation done by their people, many of the sightings were attributed to natural phenomena such as flights of birds, planets, meteors, and possibly cloudiness. So they continued with that. Dr. Fred L. Whipple of Harvard, a memorandum of his laboratory dated the 9th of August, 1950, relative to this problem, indicated that he observed a tendency for the occurrence of small detached clouds in New Mexico, which might have been mistaken for aerial object when illuminated by the reflective light of the moon. So here we go. We got another one of the government scientists coming on board trying to now state that with the clouds that are in New Mexico and the type of clouds they are, it was the reflection from the moon at night that was going and showing these objects. More cover-up. Dr. Whipple investigated the possibility of the correlation between the frequency of aerial observation and weather conditions, specifically cloudiness. A rough analysis of available weather data indicated that on 53 nights between December 5th, 1948 and the 5th of March, 1951, when observations were reported, 10 were clear, 24 partially cloudy, and 5 completely overcast, and 14 had no record. The number of cloudy nights involved seems unusually high for New Mexico. The weather reports were for the Las Cruces area only were as many as observations were considerable distance from La Cruz. So further investigations is therefore necessary to determine correlations with cloudiness. So, I mean, he was really trying and the data was not working up, not going with it. So Dr. Whipple also conducted a study as to whether the age of the moon was related to the frequency of aerial phenomenon observations. I mean, they just tried every which thing, especially Dr. Whipple, to get this covered up. It's it makes you laugh. So no farther physical expenditure was made in pursuing the problem. The opinion was promptly parted by fruitless expenditure during the past year, the last year of the project. The uncertainty of existence of unexplainable aerial objects and the inactive position currently taken by Holloman Air Force Base, as indicated by the standby status of the project. So basically, they weren't doing much, so they just closed the project down. And they never gave a conclusion, but they wanted the project to stay classified. Doesn't make sense to me. I don't get why you would keep something classified like that if there's nothing to it. I don't know. You know how they are. So to finish off these documents, I'm going to read this last kind of final report that they did here. Let's see here. Okay. So generally the results of a 6-month contract period may have described was negative, although the photographic theodolites functioned continuously. So they still kept the camera up, the one camera they were able to be funded, but they were supposed to have multiple cameras, remember that, but the military wouldn't fund them enough money to do that. So the scientists couldn't properly do investigations anyway, publicly at least. The grading camera functioned very little since the military personnel assigned to operate them had been withdrawn due to concerns with the Korea situation. So they were really even pulling people off that were supposed to be stationed on these cameras to find these objects. Facilities for the electromagnetic frequency measurements that were to be provided by the Signal Corp engineer laboratories were not utilized due to the fact that frequency of occurrence of these phenomena did not justify the $50,000 a year transfer funds to the Signal Corps, which would be required to carry out such monitoring facility. However, the phenomena activity over Holloman Air Force Base, 150 miles south of Vaughan, New Mexico, during the later part of August 1950, was considered sufficiently significant so that the contract with Land Air was extended for 6 months, ending in 31st of March 1951. Because of the determination of the phenomenon, activity in the vicinity of Vaughan and the resumption of activity near Hofflin Air Force Base, the Alaskan cameras again were overhauled and installed at Holloman Air Force Base. This installation was completed about the 5th of November 1950. October, arrangements were made, and pilots, they just completely wiped out the entire project. They basically covered it up. I'm not even going to read any more of that. but this is what happens. This is Project Twinkle. And we don't talk about this. This is like a thing we should be talking about a lot more often when it comes to UFO history. And I think the fact is that we focus on the big stuff that has a lot of sightings. But we had 165 people witness these green, red objects, of all different types. And again, it's another question of a military cover-up. But you can go on to, like I said, theblackvault.com and read the detailed, declassified documents. But I figured I'd share that with you because in my personal opinion, if you have crashes in Roswell in 47, 48, and Socorro, all of that stuff, and then sightings continue, and they're not even just sightings by the locals like it was with the Roswell situation. These were members that people and scientists that worked in the Los Alamos lab that were seeing these things close to the base and reporting them. And also, like I said in the beginning, when we read the details of the report, these were pilots that were on Holloman Air Force Base seeing these objects flying by them, almost colliding midair. So it's just a really interesting part of that. And there has to be some kind of correlation between Roswell and Project Twinkle, and it just continued. And then the military is just going to do whatever they do to cover it up and to make things not turn up. But there's a reason they classified that entire project until when they did. It was classified for years. And to have intelligence officers talk to pilots If it was nothing, if it was just planets, why would you have intelligence officers, OSI? So that's basically it for Project Twinkle. I mean, as much as we can get into a half an episode. But I thought I would share that with you. I mean, go check out the reports. I'll put the link for the entire set of declassified documents in the description of the episode. So if anybody's interested in reading the documents, you can go do that. Definitely take advantage of it. It's something. If you haven't looked into it, it's something interesting to look at, and the details are there. And honestly, from declassifying these reports, in my opinion, this just shows the lack of investigation, the lack of want, the lack of everything by the government to want to look into these sightings, and these documents prove that. So check it out. Again, that's John Greenwald's declassified Black Vault, where all the declassified documents are. I know over at, what is this, Mystery Wire, there's also some information on it as well. Go and check it out. I hope you guys enjoyed it today. You know, some different stuff with me this time for this week. Hopefully we'll get another guest next week, and we'll be back at it. I know next month is our Women in the Field celebration. So all month long, we'll be having women guests on celebrating women in the field. So that'll be a great month to celebrate and highlight all the work that women have been doing in the field of ufology. The month after that is Experiencer Month. So it'll be all experiencers coming on, telling their stories, and just sharing their time with us. So it's going to be a great next 2 months for the show. I think you guys are going to really enjoy it. And I hope you guys learned something today. You know, I think it's some really interesting stuff for sure, which is why I shared it with you. So I want to thank everybody for tuning in to episode 123 and hanging out with your host today, Jesse Peek. We'll be back next week with another amazing episode. And like we always say, until next time, remember to keep your eyes in the sky. Well, guys, I want to thank everybody for hanging out with me this week. It's something we haven't done in a really long time, and I know sometimes, you know, when you're listening to somebody read stuff, it can be a little difficult, but I appreciate you hanging out, trying to just get some information out to you guys, read the details and stuff. UFO history is important, and I think we need to stay educated on the subject, so I appreciate you hanging out with me today. I would like to do more episodes like that if you guys are interested and like that kind of stuff, so if you do like these kind of episodes, please make sure you leave a comment in the, wherever you listen at. Spotify would be great. If you listen on Spotify, leave a comment on there. Let me know you enjoyed this kind of episode, and we'll do more of them if that's what you guys like. You like this kind of information. I have no problem doing more of them if that's what you want to listen to. But we will be bringing guests back on. And like I said in the episode, next month we are celebrating Women in the Field. So it will be women all month long coming on, sharing their adventure, their story, their work, their research. And we're going to highlight them because they're important and they're a big part of this field and they're doing a lot of big things. So I want to help do that. So that should be a great time. And hopefully next week we'll be back with another episode. Like I said, if you guys are looking for a cool conference this year, the 2024 Curiosities Festival on May 4th. It's $5 a ticket per person. That includes 3 different speakers, live performances, live bands, over 100 vendors, food, a planetarium, doing classes all throughout the day, and that ticket is everything is included in that ticket. You cannot beat it. And family 5-packs are $20. So check it out. If you guys want tickets, go over to my website at ufoencountersworldwide.wordpress.com. And we'll see you guys again next week. So remember to keep your eyes in the sky.